CJSF is practicing social distancing, so this episode was produced remotely.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. Jesse here for Speak Up. Oh my goodness. Thank you for bearing with me with all the technical difficulties as we get this remote show started here on Thursday morning, July 23rd. Is that what it is already? Oh my goodness. Almost August. I am Jesse, broadcasting from my living room this morning, and I'll be sharing a pair of interviews with you from two people who are related, literally. A few months ago, I interviewed Dr. Dana Lipofsky about her work and some work with Indigenous communities on the Pacific Northwest coast. And last week, I interviewed Dana's daughter. And Gavia is doing some research on amphibians in the Pacific Northwest and how climate change is impacting them in ways beyond what we had already realized. So those two interviews together are going to make up the majority of the show. I'm going to get started right away with the interview with Gavia Lertzman-Lipofsky about agar amphibians.
My name is Gavia. I'm currently a graduate student at U of T, and I'm here today to talk about some of the work that I started as an undergrad at Simon Fraser University in Wendy Palin's lab in biology. I was a really excited undergraduate student and reached out to her to volunteer in her lab, I think in my first year. This is a project that sort of spun out of the opportunities that she gave me to work with her and her grad student, Amanda Kissel, and the data that we collected in the summer of 2014 turned into this paper.
The paper you're referring is Water Loss and Temperature Interact to Compound Amphibian Vulnerability to Climate Change, which was just published in Global Change Biology. Why amphibians in the Pacific Northwest? What brought you to this topic of research particularly?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a bunch of things, one of which is that I just love amphibians of all sorts, frogs in particular, and grew up watching them and catching them and sort of studying them as a six-year-old. And so as a university student, I sought out opportunities to engage with amphibians. And so Wendy Palin, one of the things she specializes in is amphibian conservation. And so that's one of the reasons I reached out to her, so that I could continue my fascination with these animals. But as well, amphibians are sort of facing critical pressures in today's world due to climate change and habitat loss. And so they're sort of critically important to study from a scientific perspective now, to understand rates of extinction and which ones are decreasing in population numbers and why, and understanding what the effects of our changing world is going to have on them.
What is the primary thesis or finding of the research?
Under climate change, particularly in this area in the Pacific Northwest, summers are predicted to get much hotter. And concurrently with that, there's going to be less rainfall, so they're going to be drier. And sort of when we think of the summer is going to get longer. So snow is in the mountains is going to melt out earlier in the spring and start falling later in the fall. And for amphibians, they're called a wet-skinned ectotherm, which relates to the process of how their skin acts to cool them down. And so basically, as a frog heats up, their primary mechanism for cooling themselves down is by evaporative water loss. So water escapes through their skin, sort of like the way humans sweat. And so as a frog is sitting in the sun looking for food or whatever, it's going to heat up and it's going to lose water via water loss to try and cool itself down. And at that point, if they're still too hot and they're losing too much water, they can go sit in the shade or they can go sit in the water and try and sort of cope with these environmental pressures on them heating up. And historically, when people have looked at the effects of climate change on frogs, they've really focused in on this temperature aspect. So how quickly are they going to hit a temperature that they're going to die at? And how quickly are they going to do that under current climates and under climate change where it's gotten a lot hotter? But really critically for frogs, as I've explained, water loss is a really important part of this process. And so what we did is we used these agar model frogs, these replicate frogs, to measure how quickly frogs would lose water and hit these really high temperatures across different types of habitats in the environment. And we found that because of the increasing temperatures due to climate change, they're going to be really hot or lose too much water no matter where they're sitting in the environment. So if they're going to sit in the sun, which might be really optimal for trying to find food, they're going to be too hot and lose too much water for maybe up to 95% of the summer in the 2080s. But if they're sitting in the water, they're not going to lose water because they can reabsorb water, but they're going to be too hot. And so it means that they're going to be too hot and lose too much water, but they don't really have any options of what to do.
In a way that is very particular to amphibians, this shows the complex interactions between results of climate change that often like amplify each other in a way that is sort of representative of the issues at large, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's not a simple issue, right? We might, as scientists, we tend to focus in on these specific parameters and be like, aha, we understand what's going on in the system. But there's so many things going on and they all interact.
Is that a little overwhelming or disheartening in a way? Because it seems like the way that most scientists are trained or taught to focus is sort of one issue at a time.
Yeah, I think it's something I'm definitely still learning how to do, like figure out what of the system is the important part to distill down to. And then so we zoom out at the end of the project, how to make it still relevant to real life in the real world. I'm really lucky that my mentors are really good at doing that. And so I've been able to watch them and sort of learn from the best in how to do that. But yeah, it can be really complicated.
Yeah, I think it also reflects or just parallels a growing interest and in understanding in academia and society generally of the importance of a more sort of holistic or intersectional understanding of systems and the issues that impact these systems.
Totally. And in particular, like some scientists really like to pretend that they're operating in a vacuum outside of human society. But something that has been really instilled in me is that the questions that we choose to ask and the way we go about answering those questions is a product of how we were raised and the academic institutions we're from. And so nothing happens in a vacuum.
Right. The questions you choose to ask are all shaped by all of that. Turning to the nuts and bolts of the work itself, what was your role in the research or collection of data itself? Were you in the field or are you working from a previous set of data?
I was in the field. So Amanda Kissel, who is now, she has her PhD. She was the PhD student with Wendy when I was working in the lab. And she and I spent the summer of 2014 in Olympic National Park and Mount Rainier National Park working, collecting data for her thesis, as well as putting out these agar frog models, these fake frogs, into these different environments to calculate what a real frog would be experiencing. And so from late June to September, basically as soon as the snow melted to as soon as the snow started to fall again, we would backpack into these mountains for 3 or 4 days and put out these frog models in sunny environments and shaded environments and wet environments, and then take measurements and record them. And then we came back to the lab, and over the next 3 years, I worked on that data to clean it up and to analyze it. It turned into my honors project and then eventually this paper.
What was your favorite part of doing that?
Oh, there were so many great parts and so many mosquitoes for some of it. So this was really the first time I had done real science. So every step of the process was exciting to me and interesting and really got me engaged into the process of doing research. And I'm really, really thankful that I had this experience because it sort of set me on the track for the rest of my degree and what I'm doing now. I think my favorite parts were seeing the sunset on Mount Rainier in like a field of wildflowers.
Wow.
That was just spectacular. And every time I saw that through the summer, I was like, oh, I am the luckiest person. I can't believe I get to do this. Yeah. And then sort of on the flip side, I discovered that I love data analysis and I love statistics and I loved that end of it too. And so sort of the twin like portions of being in the field and getting to interact with the natural environment and then also sitting at my computer and working to analyze this data was also really awesome.
Was that a surprise to you that you liked working with data?
It was a surprise to me, not at all to my parents, who are both profs at SFU. But yeah, no, it's great.
I'm very interested in the agar models of frogs for a couple reasons, because like my partner is a vegan chef, and so she uses agar as a replacement for gelatin in a lot of things. So it's just weird to see it somewhere else out in the scientific world. But how did that come about? Like, is this something that had been done previously elsewhere?
Mm-hmm. So this is one of the really fun parts about this project. So agar models, agar is cool. It's like a seaweed extract, right?
Yeah.
And it's often used in cooking. It's edible. The stuff we were using was not food grade. But basically, so what we were doing is we'd put agar powder, mix it up with some water, boil it in the microwave, add a couple dots of dye to it, paint, and then set it in these molds. So the agar would harden in the shape of these frogs that we were then using in the experiment. And there's lots of other people who've done this in the literature. Agar is cool because it loses water and is the same temperature as a real live amphibian. So you can get these really non-invasive ways of understanding what is going on for a frog. The method we were using, Primofine, is largely adapted from one of our co-authors, Barry Sinervo, and we worked together to design the experiment and how we would work with the agar frogs in the environment.
That's great. And just the idea of these little fake, but in all the important scientific ways, the same as a real frog just sitting out there it's a fundamental image.
Exactly. Totally. It was one of my jobs for the summer to make these agar frogs. And so I became very well acquainted with sort of working with agar and how to like get the agar frogs to look the most realistic. The agar models actually really resemble a frog, except they're quite a bit glossier, like complete with like the warts on a toad and like little toes. And so it was quite fun.
Well, it sounds like if you ever need a passion to turn into a side hustle, you've always got agar models of frogs.
Yeah, totally.
And in terms of the research and the findings, the idea that climate change and the general warming of extension of summer months and the warming of temperatures is also going to have impacts on humidity and dehydration. It seems, and I don't know if it's the right term, but it seems sort of common sense, right? It makes sense that one of these impacts would have effects on the others, although maybe that's not commonly the way it's presented. Was there anything that surprised you about what you learned through the research?
Yeah. So it's common knowledge that climate change isn't going to be the best for most amphibians. But I think none of us expected our results to be quite so bad. I remember sort of making the first of the figures in the paper and looking at it, and I color-coded it where red meant worse off it was. And the whole figure was red. And at first I went, oh my God, it's so pretty. And then I went, oh my gosh, that's horrible. Like, that's horrifying.
Yeah.
That means 95% of the summer is going to be inaccessible to these animals. So that was a shock.
The research and the conclusions that you've drawn from the research are based on predictions about or previous data that predict how climate change will play out by the 2080s. Can you describe the model that's informing these predictions?
We used forecasts from IPCC that are under the business as usual approach. And so these are under the scenario where climate emissions sort of will continue as we're doing now without any major increases or decreases to our behavior. So it's sort of like the middle of the road.
Things continue as they currently are, by and large.
Yeah, exactly. So like nothing drastic is getting like really bad or really poor better. And that is the data that has gone into informing our models.
with those numbers being where they are, as you said, 95% of the land during the summer, 74% of wetland edges being uninhabitable in the summer months. And I mean, you might not have the answers yet. Is this reversible, or is it possible to mitigate these impacts at this point?
I would like to think so, for sure. I think it partially depends on what humans as a sort of global society end up being able to do to combat climate change more broadly. Amphibians definitely have a hard go of it in terms of habitat loss in urban environments and rural environments too, for that matter. Yeah, I am hopeful, but I don't know if that's naive or because there is actually reason to be hopeful.
Right. You mentioned that amphibians are particularly vulnerable to climate change and the changes to their habitats that result. What is the importance of amphibians to the ecosystem as a whole?
Amphibians play a really important role in as a food source for other animals and sort of as the eating insects. But the way I sort of see it is that most species have some sort of inherent, like, if they're experiencing problems due to climate change that is human induced, it is on us to try and mitigate that for them. Bing. It's not a great answer, but it's a hard question.
No, I get it. It's not necessarily that, like, oh, if this group of animals no longer exists, then XYZ happens. That it's also that them ceasing to exist is in itself a negative and is in itself a bad thing.
Yes.
Especially if it's human induced.
That is exactly what I was trying to express.
What would you like to see come from this research?
So scientifically, I think I would like to see this work really highlights the importance of incorporating water loss and evaporation into these models of understanding how amphibians will respond to climate change. And so moving forward, I would like to see other people take that up, and rather than ignoring water loss, as has been the common practice, to use water loss and temperature synthetically and at the same time in models that sort of try to understand amphibian behavior, because they're both really important. From a sort of more social standpoint, I think people having a general knowledge of how their actions affect the natural world is really important.
Okay, Gavia, I think that's all I have. Is there anything else that is important that we didn't touch on?
I think that's everything. Maybe just, like, I am so grateful to my co-authors and my collaborators on this project. And really, they're my mentors. They have been working with me since 2014, and I owe so much to them and have learned so much from them through this whole process.
Yeah, it was a shock to hear 2014, and then you realize that that's how long research takes.
Yes, exactly.
And what's next for you?
So I'm a grad student at U of T. I'm hoping to do my PhD there, and I study community evolution of anolis lizards in the Caribbean. So that's going to be my life for the next little while. Also super exciting.
Well, I'm excited to hear about that once it's published or out in the world one way or another.
Yeah.
Well, thank
you.
Sure,
that'd be fun. Thank you.
Gavia Lertzman-Lipovsky talking about agar amphibians and climate change here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. The paper that Gavia co-authored is called Water Loss and Temperature Interact to Compound Amphibian Vulnerability to Climate Change. You can find that in Global Change Biology if you've got a research access. Otherwise, there's lots of summaries floating out there. Up next is going to be a replay of an interview I did with Gavia's mother, Dana, a few months ago about her work as an archaeologist and ethnobiologist. And that's coming up now.
I'm Dana Lepofsky, and I teach here at Simon Fraser University in the Department of Archaeology. And I'm super privileged in that I get to work here on the Northwest Coast with Indigenous communities, for Indigenous communities in their territories, thinking about and investigating how people lived on the land in the past and placing that knowledge in kind of current social and ecological contexts.
How did you get into archaeology? Like, how did that become the channel?
Every archaeologist loves being asked this question. Mm-hmm. I got into archaeology, like a lot of archaeologists, when I was little, and in my backyard. I used to make Patty Gantel, my childhood friend, dig in my backyard with me. She hated it. I loved it. There wasn't ever thing close to an archaeological site, but we had fun. I had fun. She didn't. And then I forgot about that and my interest in kind of the past and in people until I got to university and actually took a terrible anthropology class, just awful. But still, it just resonated with me at my core that there was something there that I could do. So a lot of people, like, tell archaeologists, it's very common, I always wanted to be an archaeologist, but. Mm-hmm. So for me, I never had to face that, but because I happened to be at University of Michigan, which was at that time one of the leading archaeology programs in the world, probably, I had a supportive family. I just, like, the universe just unfolded to make it happen for me, so I don't have a but. I just got to do it, and I'm really, really lucky.
What then drove the connection to sort of Pacific Northwest, West Coast, Indigenous groups, and that field of archaeology?
Right. So I always tell my students that in your job cover letters, you make it sound like you had a direct path, mm-hmm. and that you knew where you were going to end up by doing all these steps. It was completely not the case. I was, went on my first ever backpack trip with my boyfriend, and we were hiking the peninsula and the Cascades, and on the first trip, I saw my first switchbacks and had to carry my first backpack. And it was hard, hard, hard. At that point in my life, I wasn't really using my body physically like that. And we had to take a break because I was so sore. So we took the ferry to Victoria and went to the museum there. And that museum turned my life around, my head around. Mm-hmm. And on the ground floor was a sculpture of Nutchalmouth whaling, then Nootka whaling. And I was completely... Oh my God, I still can bring up that feeling. I was so taken by it. So I went back to Michigan and decided to do my honors thesis on Nutchalmouth whaling. And really, the rest is history.
Full disclosure, I am a graduate of the archaeology program here at SFU. Not currently awesome. Working as an archaeologist, yeah. But there's a feeling I get, and I have gotten going to...
BC Provincial Museum, it's not called that anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, the BCPM, yeah.
I can remember... certain exhibits there and other places that it's almost like you see them or enter the space with them, and it's almost like the hair on the back of your neck stands up.
Yeah, there's some visceral connection.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I that's clearly what happened with that Nutchalmouth whaling exhibit, because it shaped my life in a way that I couldn't have known, but I did know that it kind of just, I don't know, it just hit a core value, a core interest, a core passion. You know, I never thought that I would end up, you know, fast forward in the McCall Longhouse trying whale blubber. You know, I just, you know, I didn't know that cell of my universe would unfold, but that was a pivotal moment.
And so since then, you've obviously studied a lot of things and done a lot of different work. One of the things that seems to be a through line, or has become a through line anyway, is this sort of interdisciplinary approach and the marrying of different information sources and different approaches. Did that just sort of develop organically?
So it's interdisciplinary, intercommunity for me. So that means, like you said, different knowledge sources, whether they be in the academic world or outside. In a way, part of it developed organically because I'm a community kind of person. I just went back and visited the community that I grew up in, Connecticut, and I realized how much that was part of kind of who I am, that I'm used to being in community. I create community if there isn't around me. And also cultural diversity, the place I lived in Connecticut was a lot of quote-unquote ethnic diversity. So diversity and community were kind of in my fabric, and I came from a family where that was embraced. So that was a big part of who I am. I'm also kind of a party organizer. I like bringing people together. Mm-hmm. That's part of being interested in community, sure. But I also like organizing events. Everyone knows in the family there's going to be an event that I'll organize it. So it meant that kind of really to satisfy my passions and really to tackle some of these problems that were difficult, it made sense to bring in different kinds of knowledge holders and diverse kinds of methods and to be respectful to those different kinds of knowledges, whether they're from, you know, the Department of Biology here or from indigenous communities somewhere in the world, that we all bring different kinds of ideas and skills, strengths and weaknesses to the table. So what's neat is that, for me, is that the discipline has changed or evolved in that this is now becoming the, it's quite common, mm-hmm. or increasingly common for people to do interdisciplinary work and to look to indigenous knowledge holders and bring them in. It's not as common as it should be yet, but it's definitely evolving. So I frankly have never been happier with my work as an archaeologist. My privilege has never been greater than it is now.
Well, it's interesting because there's, as you were saying, it's becoming more common to seek out different sources of information and knowledge. But in archaeology and in just sort of, I guess, Western scientific pursuit generally, there has been this sort of idea that if you're not part of the people who know, who are doing things the one specific way, then there's not as much value to it.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and that's still, I mean, it's still there. That's still very much there. So I heard correctly saying it's evolving. It hasn't. We haven't arrived by any means. There's a paper that just came out that several of us are actually writing a rebuttal to, and that they tout interdisciplinarity, and they say, look how great we are. We're looking at this, and we can show that basically indigenous land use has not left a legacy in the ecological record today, and that it really was never very extensive in the past. Well, they actually do bring a lot of kinds of paleoecological data like pollen and charcoal and archaeology in this case, but they forgot to talk to indigenous people or to look at kind of the ethnographic record in detail. And so a more nuanced and interesting question would be, given that there is so much evidence in the ethnographic record or, you know, among knowledge holders of this kind of behavior of traditional management or whatever, why aren't we finding it in the paleoecological records? To me, that would be true breadth of knowledge seeking. And so you can see in that case that knowledge is defined very particularly about those who have it inside the academy. Yeah, you're quite right.
I know that in, and this is again drawing on the schooling in archaeology that I've had here, that in classical archaeology, in a lot of other branches of archaeology, like you would look back at written materials and you would say, what do these tell us and how does the archaeological record conflict with this or confirm this? And barring that, you go back and you look at who are the ethnographic descendants of the people who had these lifeways or who were living here. But it's interesting that the archaeological evidence seems to have sort of like a primacy, or that seems to be, well, if this is what the hard science tells us, then that must be what's quote-unquote right.
That's such a good observation, and I really think that social scientists, and in fact all scientists, maybe not all, maybe not physicists, I actually don't know, but a lot of scientists are grappling with that idea of kind of what is right. How do you know you're right how do you know? And kind of the standard way would be hypothesis testing and kind of, you know, but even in the hypothesis testing language, you're not supposed to ever say that you've proven a hypothesis, it's just the one that's currently standing. So probably that language and that framework isn't the best way for dealing with traditional knowledge and embracing traditional knowledge. I think, though, that in North American archaeology, anyway, there's definitely been a definite move toward embracing that knowledge, and meaning that you have to do a different kind of science. So I'm put in for a proposal, and they want to know my methods. And I have a line in there saying that there is angst around telling you what my methods are, given that this is a community-based project, and I want the methods to arise. So I'll tell you how I'm going to meet with the community and what we're going to do to develop those methods. But it's going to look really different depending on community needs and community desires. So that alone from like the ground up is going to look different than, you know, how it would be if I'm going to go out and tell exactly where I'm going to sample and what I'm going to sample. Mm-hmm. So that grant could be dead in the water if it goes to my colleagues who believe that there's one right way to do archaeology. And it could.
It's interesting because that, like the differences in experimental design, I guess, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm. those are going to determine the kind of information that you get as
100%.
Well, right?
Exactly. I think that that has been a recognition increasingly in science is that, you know, the answers we get are depend on how we crafted the question, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so for sure. So once we start bringing communities in and asking what questions do you want to ask, that will determine our methods. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, 100%. And that's appropriate here because we're talking about heritage. We're talking about someone else's heritage. Mm-hmm. Who gets to talk about that heritage and decide that. There are some ethical baselines that, you know, we won't go beyond as archaeologists. But, you know, my ethical baseline is try to find out the maximum information with the minimum amount of disturbance to the archaeological record. That's the kind of foundational model I have for my research design. After that, it's all fair game.
You talked a little bit earlier about sort of having to take new approaches or different sciences or different scientific approaches. You're part of a speaking event that's coming up next week, February 6th, I think, that is called The Marriage of...
It's called...
The New Power Couple.
Yeah, yeah, which actually, you know, full disclosure, that had to be explained to me because I'm so not connected to popular culture, but everybody else knew but me.
The New Power Couple, Traditional Ecological Knowledge and Western Science Unite to Inform Sustainable Management of Clams. So that seems like you're talking about a way of potentially marrying two different streams or using one source of knowledge to inform another.
That's exactly right. And I think that the best kind of discussion is an iterative one. So actually, it is a backing and forth thing because there's a lot of truths in science that don't hold up, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of truths in oral knowledge that don't hold up, or I don't know, a lot in both ways, but there are some in both contexts. So that backing and forth thing is a really exciting thing, I think. So in this talk, I'm so lucky that I'm going to actually be kind of bookended by two extraordinary knowledge holders, Kim Rakalma Kludisi Ogiloga from the Qualicum Nation, who was married to Kwaksisala Wathla, Chief Adam Dick, who just passed about a year and a half ago, was one of the major knowledge holders of the Kwak Kwak Kwak. And so she's going to be talking about kind of clams and clam gardens and how that knowledge was brought forward to the Western scientific community through Adam, and Adam actually singing a song and all the knowledge that's embedded in song. And then on the other side is going to be Elroy White, who's an archaeologist, got his degree from our department, and Kitasu, I think, is one of his traditional names. And Elroy will talk about kind of clam management, clam use, clam gardens in his territory and how clams sit today. So I'm in the middle, kind of, again, bookended by these amazing knowledge holders talking about kind of the Western scientific perspective and what have we learned about clams and clam gardens, really kicking off from Adam's knowledge and Elroy's knowledge and other people like that. So it's very much a marriage of different ideas. And it, it's been quite the ride.
Yeah, well, I was really interested. I mean, that's sort of an intersection of my interests in terms of like music and archaeology, and the idea that in an article you co-authored, songs are described as detailed biocultural archives.
Yeah.
And that phrase to me just it like set off all sorts of things in my brain. It's such an, I don't know, it's just a very interesting concept and something I don't know if you would necessarily just on its face think of a song being a biocultural archive.
Well, do you as a musician? Like now, did that resonate
with you? It
makes
sense, for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm listening at this moment to a podcast that's each episode is an hour-long breakdown, lyrical analysis of an album, and each hour-long episode is one song.
That's
and,
amazing.
Just thinking about that and thinking about the kind of information that you are able to convey through lyrics and through references and through just all the different meaning in there is very interesting.
Yeah, so this whole song journey, I live with musicians, mm-hmm. so, you know, I'm totally a wannabe, and so I appreciate music and all that in the ways that you know, touches your heart and body and soul and mind, and just, you know, that the power of music that way. But how this is a whole volume that came about in the, it's a special issue of the Journal of Ethnobiology, which I edit, called The Ethnobiology of Songs. And it looks at traditional songs of indigenous people around the world, and asks what's all the biocultural, the ethnobiological information embedded in them. How this came about was through Kwaksi Stala Wathla, through his singing of the Lokiwe song. And that's what introduced me to Kwaksi Stala, to Adam, and Adam became a dear friend and mentor. And you'd be sitting around eating with Adam at his house, and I don't know, maybe someone would serve ooligan or something, that Adam would just start gonna get this far off look in his eyes and start tapping on the table and to a beat and sing you a song. And Adam knew hundreds of songs about the way the world worked. Hundreds. So they were specific songs. And so for A Taste of Clam Gardens, it was about the Yaya song, and basically Yaya has to do with this dog tradition and these dog children, and that's one of the oldest oral traditions on the coast. It's shared by Salish people and Kwakwaka people and Helsik people, and basically it teaches, like, go down to the beach and roll the rocks to get me my clams, roll the rocks, go down to the Lohiwe. And it's really that song and all the songs that Adam shared with me, and the many, many more that he knew, are what inspired that. And I put the word out saying I want to do this special issue, and it sat for a year or so on our website, our journal website. And then my now such dear friend, Alvaro Fernandez Yamazares from Spain, contacted me and said, I'm an ethnobiologist, I'm a musician, and would you like to do this with me? And then there started this amazing journey of bringing in people around the world who were also taken by the power of song. So there, it's detailed knowledge about the way the world works, the biological world and the non-biological world, and people's place in it. And we know that about language and storytelling, but I think we've forgotten that songs have that same power. Mm-hmm. And of course they do. And so it wasn't missed by the people, the administrators in the residential schools at all. Like, you, right. You got beaten for, you know, singing a First Nations song.
Anything that wasn't a hymn.
And you got replaced with hymns. So they knew the power of song big time, which is just so interesting to me. So when I looked at the Truth and Reconciliation recommendations, they actually don't talk about song. They talk about language. Mm-hmm. It's missing. We need to actually think about song as a kind of a parallel. It's a subset. It's greater than language. There are kinds of language and stories that end up in song that never end up in spoken language. So it's more than language in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, like, what gets chosen to put into a song is, I mean, like, just simply that it has been chosen to be made into a song is relevant, but also just, like, songs are a way of encoding language as well, and then making it easier to remember specific things. Like, I remember song lyrics better than I remember just, like, a list of sentences that are unconnected.
Totally true. Mm-hmm. So it's about conveying meaning, remembering meaning, giving importance to meaning, all kinds of things are embedded in that. And what's really neat about song, too, is that there's ethnomusicologists and psychologists who have done research on song and on the universality of song, like what makes a lullaby is cross-cultural. Well, you say, yeah, but that's obvious. Well, actually, it's not.
Right. It seems obvious because it's cross-cultural.
Yeah. So they've done really neat work kind of, you know, in diverse songs, diverse cultures, looking at what are the commonalities, and there's quite a few. It's really, even talking about it, just, you know, talking about making your hair stand, and it totally, when I think of a song, you know, it's really so much into our fabric from the get-go. Mm-hmm.
The way singing makes you feel, and the way, like, it does seem much, maybe not much more, but it does seem like it exists on, like, a more fundamentally human level than any particular language might. I guess this, like, drive to music or this drive to song.
Agreed, and some of the, you know, instruments are old, like people making sounds, and the oldest instruments are really, they seem to be about making noises to talk to the plant and animal world, right? So to talk to the world around you and the plants and animals that are actually there, and the spiritual plants and animals. So it's about communication in all kinds of directions. Yeah, it's neat.
Yeah. The song you that we've sort of mostly mentioned about the clam beds and rolling the rocks so that you can get the clams. I watched, there's a video on the Hoyette website, which is hoyette.ca, that gives like a really interesting, the website itself gives just like an overview of the area and has like little sort of vignettes about different mm-hmm. parts, different sites, things like that. And there are a couple of videos of these clam beds. When you look at them and you know that they are a human feature, yeah. It's so obvious.
Yeah.
But it's also the kind of thing that until you hear someone say, oh, you roll the rocks to make the clam yeah. bed, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, so we actually put the prettiest ones, right?
Of course.
Yeah, sure. So they're the most obvious. Yeah. And, you know, there's some that are really stacked high and mm-hmm. pancake flat on the website. But there are others that are less obvious. And the truth is, they are mostly underwater. Mm-hmm. So to be fair to all of us who didn't get to hear from elders directly, that we didn't know that there were these gardens as ways of cultivating clams at the lowest intertidal, they're only really visible for like, oh, I don't know, 5 to 8 daylight hours. Is that about right? No, probably less than that. It's probably 5 to 8 days per month in May, June, July, and August. Probably for about a 3-hour window each.
Right, because it's the lowest point of
the tide. It's the lowest low.
Yeah.
That's right. And so then in places where sea level has declined, mm-hmm. has gone down since the building of the walls, they're more exposed. Obvious. Yeah, they're a little more obvious. But in places like the Gulf Islands where sea level has come up, you only get the very lowest tides, just the top mm-hmm. of the rock wall. It doesn't look like much. So if you don't know it's there, you know, it's definitely invisible. But this is a really good case of kind of not stopping and listening and recognizing indigenous knowledge, because had we asked, had we paid attention, had we come to Kwaksi-Stala, you know, a while ago, he would have said, yeah, those are Lohi way. I made ones. That's what he says. He said, I didn't understand why I was being asked the question. It seems so obvious to him. So we had an idea mm-hmm. and we were right. That clams were not cultivated, that clams were not that important. It's all about salmon, all those rock walls. If we saw them, there were fish traps for salmon, never for herring, because herring wasn't important, another truth in mm-hmm. local archaeology. Yeah, and we just needed to ask.
Well, I think that that's a through line. There are a lot of assumptions that are made based on whatever we already know or think we know, and a lot of that knowledge has been suppressed or eradicated or pushed to the margins where it's not necessarily, it's there if you ask, but if you're not, it's not presented as obviously.
Yeah. And I think worldview matters so much, because even people who are working with indigenous peoples, if you didn't believe that people were managing the foreshore or the terrestrial landscape, then it just went to twig, like you just didn't have a way to anchor it. Mm-hmm. And it really, that code was broken in the academic world by my mentor and friend, Nancy Turner. And Nance is many wonderful things, but one of them is that she's a really respectful listener. Doesn't matter who, what culture. So Nance listened all over the years, and then she started realizing they're talking about cultivation. And it was, you know, because she listened so carefully and so respectfully. And then once Nance kind of cracked the code for us about terrestrial management and management of plants, but also then kind of the occasional talking about, you know, the marine environment, then it was all fair game. And then really what we know now is that, not surprisingly, and it's true for many indigenous people around the world, and certainly coastal peoples, that they're managing from the lowest intertidal to the highest terrestrial areas in a continuum of practices that are, again, global.
Mm-hmm. Because why wouldn't you?
Yeah, why wouldn't you?
Right. And I think there is that with indigenous communities here, because they are so decimated and so secluded, well, secluded isn't the right word, but sort of concentrated away and not in...
They're like separated from urban life, for sure.
Places.
Well, in lots of cases, yeah.
But there's the mm-hmm. assumption that mm-hmm. they were only living in certain places doing certain things, mm-hmm. as opposed to
definitely
living in these areas
definitely.
And exploiting every ecological niche, and et cetera.
The thing is about BC, though, is that we're extraordinarily privileged to have really thriving Indigenous communities and Indigenous knowledge holders in the city and outside of the city. Mm-hmm. But it was just stopping to listen, like in other places of the world, is there is more of a disconnect between that traditional knowledge and the past. But even so, there are traditional knowledge holders in many places. You know, it depends on the amount of disease, the amount of colonial repression, et cetera, et cetera. But here, there's a lot of knowledge. It's extraordinary, really, that way, that there is such a thriving Indigenous population. And we live in a country that purports to support Indigenous rights and title. Now, that's a whole other interview right there. But at least that is part of what we believe we do in Canada.
Well, you've got this talk coming up at the beginning of February. What's next for you, research-wise, or ongoing for you?
What's
the next thing that you're excited about?
Yeah, so two things. I'm super excited. One is this project that I've put in that I mentioned for on one of the Gulf Islands, where I'm asking the question is, what does community-based archaeology look like? And I've invited all 13 nations who lay claims to this island to come and help us figure that out with the settler community, because I really believe that we are not going to go forward in terms of heritage preservation, conservation, awareness, respect, without bringing in the settler community into the discussion fully, because people have connections to those places as well. And so that I'm super excited about that. It's going to be a logistical, it's going to be logistically full. I'm also, we're starting a project up with the Gitgat up in around Hartley Bay. And this is talking about interdisciplinarity and crossing knowledge. This is the site where the Queen of the North went down 10, 12 years ago, whenever that was. It's a place, I can't pronounce the Somalia name, the Gitgat name for it, but it's called Clamstown in English. And it's called that for the obvious reason is that people are going to harvest clams there for generations. In fact, we have some radiocarbon dates, thousands and thousands of years. It's a stunningly beautiful site, and they've taken all these clams and terraced these, you know, beautiful house platforms. It makes for just this beautiful open forest today, and I'm fronting this very productive clam beach, which it turns out is no longer polluted from the Queen of the North going down, which was the original reason for testing the beach, but has PSP, paralytical shellfish poisoning, harmful algal blooms is a more general name for PSP being one kind of HAB, and that some of the beach has these harmful blooms. And so people are getting discouraged, thinking they can't go and collect clams anymore. So we're starting this multi-community, multidisciplinary project where we have someone who can specialize in PSP, someone else who specializes in diatoms, someone else in ancient DNA, some archaeologists, we have marine ecologists, we have elders, local ecologists, basically to ask, can you use traditional management techniques to decrease the prevalence of these PSPs? Is it the decline of traditional management techniques and harvesting that actually has led to the increase? Can we look at the archaeological record and ask, how prevalent was PSPs in the record? How, I say, fat and happy were the clams in the past? How does that compare to the clams today? So we can get this long-term record by looking at the archaeology and compare it to today, to experimental ecological design kinds of results. And then we have this wonderful pairing with the Indigenous knowledge about how they tended those beaches and so on, and the changes they see ecologically.
That's really exciting, because I think one of the things that really interests me about archaeology is how it can be used beyond just, this is what things were like back then. Taking the information that you can get from it and actually applying it in to help solve a modern day issue.
Yeah, and going full circle to my original introduction, you said there was so much. So that was the other thread, is taking the past and contextualizing it in these modern contexts. It's really, for me, we'd be squandering our privilege as archaeologists if we did something other than that. Mm-hmm. And it can be all kinds of things, just like, you know, bringing it back to the community in terms of heritage and heritage reconnection. And then, of course, all kinds of environmental concerns that we can be part of. The trick is for archaeologists, I think, is we like to say that we're relevant. But when push comes to shove, we don't sometimes go to the nth degree, because we're not policymakers. So what that means is working with policymakers, working with ecologists. We cannot be all those things. As archaeologists, we're a jack of all trades in some respects, and so that means that we can be at the center of all these multiple conversations.
Sort of interface with all the different stuff.
Absolutely, and we can be coordinators, but we need to bring all those other experts in, and a lot of those experts are going to come from the Indigenous community as well.
Well, Dana, thank you for sitting down with me.
My pleasure.
That's great. Awesome.
was my interview with Dana Lipovsky about the work that she is doing in ethnobiology and archaeology. You can find more info at cgsf.ca. There'll be a link to today's show with some more information. This has been Speak Up. I'm Jesse. Up next is Democracy Now! Going to leave you with a track by the Polaris Prize shortlisted artist Caribou. This is Never Come Back, but don't worry, I will. Next Thursday, I'll be here. See you then.